Eighth, he has to abstain from using ornaments, scents, garlands, and perfumes that beautify the person. Ninth, he has to avoid high and luxurious seats and beds. And tenth, he has to abstain from accepting gold and silver, from accepting money. During his period of training as a samanera, the young monk must study the Dhamma. He must learn the aspects of monastic discipline and prepare himself for future full ordination. The ceremony of full ordination as a bhikkhu is called upasampada. To be eligible for upasampada, the candidate first has to have been a samanera for some time, usually for several years. Though, as we said, in the case of mature men, he might just have to have been ordained as a novice earlier the same day. The candidate for bhikkhu status must be 20 years old, and he has to be free from the impediments. That is, he has to be free from certain incurable diseases like leprosy, tuberculosis, and epilepsy. He has to be a free man, not in debt. He has to be exempt from military service. And he has to have the permission of his parents. When he comes for the ordination ceremony, he must have a complete set of robes and an alms bowl. These will usually be provided by lay supporters. The ceremony of upasampada requires a sangha of at least 5 bhikkhus, but usually more are present. The sangha is headed by a senior bhikkhu of at least 10 years standing in the order, who has a good knowledge of Dhamma and Vinaya, the code of discipline. This senior monk will serve as the preceptor for the new bhikkhu. The ordination is more complex than that used for the novice ordination. First, a monk will chant a motion that such and such, the name of the candidate, requests upasampada with such and such a senior monk as his preceptor. Then 3 announcements of this fact are made, and if none of the bhikkhus present objects, then when the 3rd announcement is finished, the candidate is accepted as a bhikkhu. After the actual ordination, the preceptor then explains to the new bhikkhu the 4 things which are absolutely prohibited for a fully ordained monk. These 4 acts are firstly, engaging in sexual intercourse of any kind, whether it be heterosexual or homosexual. Secondly, taking anything of value that is not given. Third, killing another human being. And 4th, falsely claiming to have reached some higher spiritual attainment. If a bhikkhu commits any of these forbidden acts, then he is immediately expelled from the Sangha and he can never be reordained again in this lifetime. After explaining these 4 forbidden acts, the preceptor then explains the 4 supports of the homeless life. These are, first, to live on food collected on alms round. Secondly, to use robes made from cast-off rags. Third, to live beneath a tree. And 4th, to use cow's urine for medicine. But for the consolation of those who are thinking of taking ordination, it should be mentioned that these 4 observances are not compulsory. Monks are allowed to accept food offered by lay people in homes or brought to the monastery. They can wear robes already prepared by householders. They can live in buildings like temples and monasteries and cottages, and they can use any kind of proper medicine and don't have to use cow's urine at all. In fact, nowadays, in just about all Buddhist countries, the only one of the 4 supports which is commonly followed is to live on food collected on alms round. The others have pretty much fallen into neglect. But this formula is still recited as a formality, and as a way to emphasize the spirit of poverty, simplicity, and purity that are essential to the monk's life. The bhikkhu is allowed to own, as his own personal possessions, 8 articles. These include his 3 robes. One is the underrobe, called the antaravasika, which is worn around the waist, something like a sarang. The second robe is the upper robe, the uttarasanga, which is worn over the shoulder, covering the upper part of the body. And the third robe is the double thick outer robe, the sangati, which is usually worn only in cool weather. In addition to these 3, the bhikkhu will own a belt made out of cloth, an alms bowl, a razor, a needle, and a water strainer. Besides these, in actual practice, bhikkhus usually own a few other simple necessities, varying in quantity according to their lifestyle. Teaching bhikkhus in the town will need more things: extra robes, books, notepaper, pens, and so on. Meditative bhikkhus living in the forest can usually get by with very little beyond their basic requisites, perhaps just sandals, umbrella, a fan, a small clock. And the monk has to obtain his material requisites in a pure way. He doesn't work as a profession, as we said, but he receives his material requisites through the generosity of others. He's not allowed to beg for them, to coerce others to give them, or to persuade others to offer them, but he's dependent upon the generosity and the kindness of the laity. And in using the 4 principal requisites, the robes, the alms food, his shelter, and medicines, he has to reflect on their proper purposes. When he puts on his robes, he has to reflect that he uses the robes for the purpose of keeping off the cold, keeping off the heat, keeping off the sun and wind and creeping things, and for covering up the body. He reflects that he uses the alms food in order to support his life, to keep himself in good health, to prevent disease, and to live the life of holiness. He reflects that he uses his dwelling place, his shelter, to keep out the cold and heat and mosquitoes and gnats, and in order to protect himself from the weather. And he reflects that he uses medicines for the purpose of keeping off disease and for the maximum of health and well-being. Life in the Sangha is regulated by a body of rules called the Vinaya. The word Vinaya literally means leading away. That is, it's the code of rules that leads us away from wrong actions, wrong deeds of body and speech. The Vinaya is contained in the part of the Tripitaka called the Vinaya Pitaka, the Book of Discipline. And these books set forth the precepts of monastic life. Some of these precepts are moral in nature and concerned with the fundamentals of spiritual development. Others are principles of etiquette more than morality, which help to establish harmony between the monks themselves and between the Sangha and laity as a whole. The heart of the Vinaya is the code of 227 rules called the Padimokkha. These are the backbone of monastic discipline. The rules of the Patimokkha are classified into several categories of differing degrees of moral weight. The most important are the 4 parajikas, the 4 prohibited acts we already mentioned: sexual intercourse, theft, killing another human being, and making false claims to spiritual attainment. The violation of these rules leads to defeat, to expulsion from the order. 13 other rules of a somewhat lesser degree of gravity lead to a period, if they're violated, they lead to a period of penance with a temporary suspension of monastic privileges. The remaining rules vary in importance and in the consequences that are entailed when they're violated. But for good monks, it's important that they try to keep all the rules as scrupulously as they can. All the rules might not seem to be extremely serious, but the problem is that once a person starts breaking minor rules, it's often only a matter of time until he starts to break major rules. Therefore, the guiding principle for a monk who's serious in following the Buddha's path is to try to maintain and protect all the rules to the best of his ability. The foundation of the higher stages of spiritual training is moral discipline, and for a bhikkhu, the background or backbone of his moral discipline is the Patimokkha. The Patimokkha is recited by the Sangha together at a ceremony called the Uposatha, which is held on the day of the full moon and the new moon in each lunar month. And it's held in the monastery whenever there are at least four bhikkhus living together. Before the ceremony takes place, the bhikkhus meet and confess their transgressions to one another. Then they all sit together, just separated by a few inches from one another, and one senior bhikkhu in the group will recite the Patimokkha while all the others listen. And while it's being recited, if any monk remembers any transgression he's committed, then he will confess it before the group as a whole. Another special occasion of monastic life is the Vasa. The Vasa is a period of 3 months coinciding with the rainy season of India. That is, it lasts from the full moon day of July to the full moon day of October. And during these 3 months of the Vasa, the monks take up residence in a single dwelling without traveling outside, except in special cases, except in emergencies or if their presence is required someplace. And the rule requiring the bhikkhus to observe the Vasa was made by the Buddha because of the conditions in India during the time of the rain. When the rains fell, the earth would teem with vegetation, and insect life would become very abundant. So if the monks traveled around a lot, they would trample on the crops, kill insects, and ruin the people's fields. In order to prevent this, the Buddha laid down a rule requiring the monks to stay at a fixed abode for the period of 3 months. During this time, the lay people would provide them with their requisites and take care of the monks with great solicitude. And even now, even in countries where the rainy season doesn't come during this 3 month period, it's traditional for the bhikkhus to observe the retreat of the Vasa. And during this period, the bhikkhus will devote themselves with special energy to their own spiritual work. The scholar monk will devote himself with special energy to study, the meditation monk to meditation, the literary monk will devote himself to writing. Each one will make a special effort to perfect himself in his own field during this period. At the close of the Vasa, the bhikkhus will assemble and hold a ceremony which is called the Pavarana. At the Pavarana ceremony, each monk invites the other monks in the community to point out any wrong actions he might have committed during the Vasa, and to ask for the patience and forgiveness of the other monks for any wrongs he might have committed. Then, when the Pavarana is finished, then the Vasa is at an end. And usually, soon after the Vasa ends, within a month after the end of the Vasa, a major ceremony takes place, bringing together the laity and the Sangha, kind of symbolic expression of the unity of the Buddha's followers. This ceremony is called the Katina ceremony. At the Katina ceremony, the laity offer new robes to the monks who have observed the Vasa retreat. And they also bring other goods that might be needed at the temple or monastery. The Katina is almost always a very cheerful, colorful affair, which helps strengthen the bond of unity between lay people and the Sangha. All the monks, no matter what their age and standing might be, all share the same disciplinary code, the Padimokkha and the rest of the Vinaya. And all the monks are guided by the same training, the training in moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. But beyond this, the members of the order divide into two basic types as they follow one or another of the two careers which are laid down for bhikkhus. One of these is called the Gantadhura, the career of books, the path of study. The other is called the Vasudhara, the career of practice, the direct path of meditation. The two careers are not absolutely exclusive. Ideally, there should be a certain synthesis of the two, and often we find that monks who follow the study of scriptures usually do some daily meditation, while monks who follow the path of practice often have some proficiency in the scriptures. But generally, there's a tendency for specialization. Some monks emphasize the Pariyatti Dhamma, the study of the scriptures. Other monks emphasize Patipatti Dhamma, the practice of meditation. And monks following the two careers generally live in different regions. The monks who follow the career of study usually live in the cities, towns, and villages, while the monks who follow the way of strict practice usually live in the more remote areas, in the forests. This division is not so sharp, since sometimes even in the busiest city monasteries you might find monks who are devoted fully to meditation, while occasionally there are forest monasteries in which there are scriptural specialists. But the regional division between town and forest generally holds valid. The main task of the monks following the career of books is to study, teach, and expound the scriptures of Buddhism. In the Theravada tradition, the main scriptural authority is the Tipitaka, the three baskets of doctrine set down in the ancient Pali language. These three baskets are the Vinaya Pitaka, the book of monastic discipline, the Sutta Pitaka, the collection of the Buddha's discourses and the discourses of great disciples, and the Abhidhamma Pitaka, the collection of philosophical psychological treatises. And those monks who specialize in study will make it their aim to learn these scriptures as best as possible. And to learn the scriptures for the Buddhist monks in this tradition doesn't mean simply to have read the books, but what's specially stressed is memorization. In fact, for the first 400 years, the scriptures of the Tripitaka were not written down at all, but they were transmitted from teacher to pupil by way of memorization. And even today, though books are available, memorization is still emphasized. So those bhikkhus who follow the way of study will spend a great amount of time memorizing the texts, learning their meaning thoroughly, studying the commentaries written about them, and then when they gain some proficiency in study, they will take on the task of teaching others, of giving sermons and lectures, of training younger monks in the scriptures. And since the study bhikkhus live in the vicinity of the towns, villages, and cities, it is these bhikkhus who come in closest contact with the laity and thus participate in various religious rites of domestic life. Unlike the Christian monks, the Buddhist monks are not completely secluded from contact with the lay world, but they interact with the laity on just about all the key occasions of daily life, from birth to death. The main types of involvement of the Sangha with the laity are meal invitations, the chanting of suttas, and preaching. Dana, the offering of food to monks, is a great source of merit for lay people. So often a family or a group of town people will invite a number of monks to their home for an alms offering. This will often be followed by a short sermon, and then by the chanting of benedictions by the monks. In addition, special chanting sessions are also held from time to time. A group of monks will be invited to chant special protective suttas for the lay people. These suttas are called paritta, protective discourses. Then, at periodic intervals, the monks will deliver lengthy sermons. These sermons are given with much fanfare and festivity. These can be attended by large numbers of lay people who make these occasions of preaching their main opportunities for learning the Dhamma. On these special Uposatha days, the days of the full moon and the new moon, devoted lay people will go to the temples and monasteries for a whole day and night. They'll bring some simple bedding and generally stay overnight. On these occasions, they'll take the 8 precepts, living very much like novice monks and nuns. For the day and night of the Uposatha, they'll devote their time to meditation, to reciting texts, to asking questions of the monks, to quiet study. And sometimes they might get the chance to listen to several lengthy discourses which might be delivered during the Uposatha period. In contrast to the life of the town bhikkhus, the life of the forest bhikkhus is very quiet. Their time is not taken up by the bustle of outer activities, but it's mostly reserved for their inner work, for the cultivation of the mind, the development of calm and insight. In the forest hermitages, a group of monks will live together, usually under the guidance of an accomplished meditation master. They live generally in small huts situated at a good distance from one another, enough distance to assure each monk of the privacy and seclusion he needs to carry on his practice. The training of the forest monk follows the ancient pattern coming down from the time of the Buddha. We can find the descriptions of this training in many suttas spoken by the Buddha. We hear how the bhikkhu, after he's left the world, fulfills the rules of training, how he observes all the precepts very carefully and very scrupulously. Then, with this moral discipline as his foundation, he develops contentment with his robe to protect his body and with his alms food to sustain his life. And it's said that just as the bird goes about with its two wings and lives completely content only to have its two wings, so the monk goes about content simply with his robes and with his alms bowl. Then, having developed this contentment, this mind of simplicity, the monk applies himself to control of the senses. When seeing forms, hearing sounds, experiencing any sense objects, he doesn't let his mind be attracted by the desirable sense objects, but he develops strong control over the senses, keeping his senses under the command of his mind. All of his actions he performs with mindfulness and clear comprehension. He's mindful when going and coming, when looking forward and looking around, when bending and stretching, when eating, drinking, going to the bathroom, standing, sitting, falling asleep. In all activities, he practices mindfulness and clear comprehension. Then he goes off into seclusion, sits down, crosses his legs, keeps his body erect, sets up mindfulness before him, and purifies his mind of the 5 hindrances, clears the mind of lust, of ill will, of laziness and drowsiness, of restlessness and worry, and of doubt. Purifying the mind of the 5 hindrances, he tries to develop the jhanas, the absorptions, and with the absorptions as a base, he develops insight and realization. This is the path that the contemplative monk lay down in the suttas. going back 2,500 years, and in the forest monasteries of South and Southeast Asia, the same way of life is followed today. The last subject we'll deal with in this talk on the Sangha is the place of nuns in Buddhism. Now, in India, at the time Buddhism arose, women were held in a position of gross subservience to men. The laws of the Brahmins made women dependent on men in all periods of their lives. In childhood, they were dependent on their father, in maturity, on their husband, in old age, on their sons. They were bound down on all sides by domestic duties. Their main role in life was to bear children and do the household work. They received very little consideration as individuals in their own right, and their capacity for spiritual development went largely unrecognized. And it's against this background that we have to view the Buddha's move in creating a bhikkhuni sangha, an order of fully ordained nuns. As we will see, the Buddha himself hesitated to permit women to enter upon the homeless life. And when he agreed to do so, he had to lay down several special regulations for the nuns. But these have to be appreciated against the social background of the time. We shouldn't judge them in the light of our own modern egalitarian ideas. In fact, when we consider what the Buddha did for women in the historical context, we'll be able to appreciate the tremendous courage of his action in forming an order for nuns. The order of nuns was established in the early years of the Buddha's ministry. One year after his enlightenment, the Buddha returned to his homeland of Kapalabhattu, and he taught the Dhamma to his people, the Sakyas. A good number of them, men and women, achieved insight and reached different levels of realization. His own foster mother, Mahapajapati Gautami, became a stream enterer, and his father, the king of the Shakyans, became a non-returner. Several years later, the Buddha returned to Kapalabhattu to see his father, who was lying on his deathbed. And the Buddha taught the Dhamma to his father, and his father attained arhatship just before dying. Then after the king's death, the Buddha's foster mother, Mahapajapati, went to him and asked if women might be allowed to go forth into the homeless life. The Buddha did not refuse flatly, but he discouraged her from making that request. He said, "Please do not ask for women to be allowed to go forth into the homeless life." He repeated this three times. And probably he was thinking that the homeless life was difficult enough even for men to follow, so it would be much harder for these women who had been brought up and sheltered in the sheltered life of the palace. Then when the Buddha left Kapalabhattu that time, he went to Vaisali, which was about 250 or 300 miles away. And meanwhile, Mahapajapati had cut off her hair and put on saffron robes, and together with a group of Sakyan women, she set out for Vaisali. And when she arrived in Vaisali, the Venerable Ananda saw her standing there. Her feet were swollen, her limbs were covered with dust, and she was very sad and unhappy, with tears on her face. And Venerable Ananda saw her and asked her why she was standing there like that. She explained to him that it was because the Buddha would not allow the women to go forth. Then Ananda approached the Buddha, and on behalf of the women, he asked for permission for the women to go forth into homelessness. And three times he asked, and three times the Buddha again didn't refuse, but he told Ananda, "Do not ask for women to be allowed to receive the going forth." After the third time, the Venerable Ananda used a different tactic. He asked the Buddha, he said, "Venerable Sir, is it possible for women to achieve the paths and fruits? Is it possible for them to achieve arhatship?" The Buddha said, it's possible, Ananda. Then Ananda said, if this is so, and since Mahaprajapati has been so helpful to you, when your mother died, she became your foster mother and gave you milk to drink and took care of you in every way. For this reason, it would be good if women could obtain the going forth. And when Ananda said this, then the Buddha said that he would allow women to go forth and become bhikkhunis, fully ordained nuns, if they would agree to 8 principles. These 8 principles all have the effect of making the bhikkhuni sangha, the order of nuns, to some extent subordinate to the order of bhikkhus, and of requiring the nuns to show special respect and reverence for the bhikkhus. It seems that one of the great dangers the Buddha foresaw was that the holy life might become corrupted if there was unregulated contact between bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. He therefore laid down these special rules as conditions that would make such contact difficult. And these rules, as we said, also serve to subordinate the order of nuns to the order of monks. And this will doubtlessly raise some objections among modern advocates of equal rights. But we shouldn't judge the Buddha against present-day standards. We have to see him against the social background of his time. In those days, women were severely restricted, and even to allow them to go forth into homelessness was a radical measure. If the Buddha had made the 2 orders precisely equal, he would have risked losing the respect of lay people, and his teaching might have disappeared without flourishing. But by making these rules, he was able to retain the respect of lay people and to ensure that his teaching would thrive. Once the order of bhikkhunis was formed, it attracted women from all different walks of life. Women of royal stock, wealthy women, poor women, ordinary housewives, courtesans, young girls, and so on, left their homes to put on the yellow robes of Buddhist nuns. A good number of these women practiced the path to its goal, achieving arhatship. Some became prominent members of the Sangha, masters of meditation, excelling in wisdom, in concentration, in learning, in supernormal powers. A few of the nuns who gave discourses which have been included in the Sutta Pitaka, and the verses of the nuns who reached arhatship have been collected together into a single book of the Sutta Pitaka, the Terigata, the verses of the elder nuns. Like the Bhikkhu Sangha, the order of nuns had its own Patimokkha. This contained over 300 rules, more than that for the order of monks, as some special regulations were needed for women. One of the regulations for the bhikkhuni sangha, which was to have unfortunate consequences, was the requirement that a woman novice had to receive full ordination from both orders, the order of monks and the order of bhikkhunis. For several centuries, the bhikkhuni sangha continued to flourish in India. During the 3rd century BC, King Ashoka allowed his own daughter, Sanghamitta, to become a bhikkhuni. And together with a group of nuns, Sanghamitta traveled to Sri Lanka with a branch of the Bodhi tree, and she helped establish the bhikkhuni sangha in the island of Sri Lanka. After Sanghamitta had set up the bhikkhuni sangha in Sri Lanka, many women from all the different strata of Sinhalese society joined the order, which became famous for the saintliness and piety of its nuns. The bhikkhuni sangha continued to thrive in Sri Lanka for many centuries, even up to the 10th century AD, and during this period it received the support of the king and the royal government and the enthusiastic support of the laity. However, due to a series of invasions from South India, the bhikkhuni sangha seems to have died out in Sri Lanka in the 10th century AD, while in India the order also disappeared, when we do not know. And since ordination as a bhikkhuni has to be received from an existing sangha of bhikkhunis, when the latter has died out, then ordination becomes impossible and the lineage cannot continue. And it cannot be revived by bhikkhus, by lay people, or anyone else, but only by a Buddha. Thus, when the bhikkhuni sangha disappeared in India and Sri Lanka, this meant the end of the lineage, as a Theravada Buddha sangha had not yet been established in Burma, Thailand, or the other Southeast Asian countries. But though the formal bhikkhuni sangha disappeared from the Theravada Buddhist world, Theravada Buddhist women continued to be drawn to the monastic life. As a result, there have sprung up in the main Theravada countries orders of women who live together as nuns, taking a less formal ordination and following the holy life according to the model of the ancient bhikkhunis. These women generally observe 8 or 10 precepts. The 10 precepts are the same as the precepts for a novice monk. The 8 precepts are obtained by dropping the 10th precept and by joining together the 7th and 8th. These women nuns shave their heads and they wear distinctive robes, which may be saffron, brown, or white. They live sometimes in special sections of the monasteries separated from the monks. Sometimes they live in convents of their own. Like the monks, some nuns specialize in meditation, some specialize in study. Others engage in social services such as teaching, rural development, hospital service, and so on. Unfortunately, these women are not accorded the same reverence that's given to the monks, so they have to maintain themselves either by their own collected funds or by donations from relatives. Materially, their life can be very difficult at times. However, in the present day, as more attention is coming to be paid to the nuns, popular attitudes are beginning to change. In the future, it may be possible for the nuns to receive the outward support they deserve in order that they can live the holy life in its full purity. In addition, the nuns themselves are gaining a stronger collective awareness, and in the several Theravada countries are beginning to form organizations to improve their status and to increase their means of support. It is to be hoped that these efforts will be fruitful and that in the present day nuns will be able to regain the eminence they enjoyed in the past and to live the holy life as it was intended for them by the Buddha.